You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining us this month to talk about the amazing world of Superman Treasury Edition, well, who else could it be? Podcasting's own Michael Bailey. Hi, Michael. Welcome back.
I was about to say, well, it could have been Henry Bernstein or Chris Franklin, but I appreciate that it's me. So.
Yes, you're right. There are many, many great Superman fans, and I don't mean to slight the other Superman fans out there, but I'm always happy to. It's been a long time since we podcasted together, and we've talked about doing this for a little while, so I'm very happy to have you back on the show talking about a Superman treasure.
Yeah, and this one especially, since it recently got and I know you're as staggered by this as I, that they're reprinting Treasuries and hardcover. Oh,
yes. I'll buy every one that DC chooses to do. It doesn't matter. Rudolph Summer Fun, doesn't matter. I'll buy it. Just put them out, DC. You got at least one sale.
I'd buy that, too, because those Rudolph ones are super expensive on the secondary market. So.
What a crazy world we live in. So, yes, we're here to talk about, as I said, The Amazing World of Superman Treasury Edition. This is a unique book. It's not part of DC's famous first edition series or their limited collector's edition series. It was a one-off that was made especially for Superman Land. And for those of you out there who aren't familiar with Superman Land, well, what the hell is Superman Land? Well, it was a Superman-themed park that was initially planned to be built in Metropolis, Illinois in the early 70s. And they had, I don't know, it certainly wasn't, obviously wasn't a groundbreaking ceremony because they never built the park, but I guess it was, I don't know what the event was that would make it that they would then print a Treasury Edition to sell, but this thing was sold not in newsstands or anything as far as I know, because there's no UPC code on it or anything like that. I don't think it was ever sold in that format. It was sold exclusively at the park, and copies eventually showed up. And as Michael just mentioned, it was reprinted in hardcover a year or two ago. I mean, not to slight the book, I'm kind of baffled as to why they did it.
Yeah.
It's not tied into anything in particular, but nevertheless, I'm happy to have it because as you just said, Michael, anytime DC is going to reprint a Treasury in the full size in any format, I'm going to buy it. So you have both editions. You have the original and the reprint.
Yeah. This was, the original was an early eBay purchase.
Right, okay.
Back in the early 2000s. I saw it, I was just like, what the hell is this thing? And I was not as steeped in certain things as I am now, where now I could tell you, oh, it's the Treasury thing and blah, 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 and limited collector's editions. And I could go to, you know, Mike's Amazing World of Comics and pull up the exact number. But it came in the mail and I'm like, oh, this is cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, you know, I've heard of Metropolis, Illinois, because at that point I had not gone. And, and then, you know, when they solicited that they were going to put a hardcover in of it, I'm like, oh, I'm there. Mm-hmm. I just have to have it just because this is such a weird artifact.
yes. Co-sign to that.
You had me on to talk about the Superman 2 Treasury. We do need to have, before we get started, a moment of silence upon recently learning that Jerry Conway was going to write the Treasury-sized adaptation of Superman the movie.
I had never heard that. And then you tweeted it at me, and my heart died a little that moment, because I never knew that. I never heard that they were ever going to do an adaptation. I never thought that that was ever a possibility. I thought it was always because of the Puzo contract. It was, you know, it was never even considered. And to know that it was considered and that Jerry Conway was planned to write it and then it got scrapped is just like, oh,
I think what you said was appropriate. I will not be taking questions during this difficult time.
Yeah, I'm sorry, everyone. I can't. I just have to crawl under my my pinball machine and in my DC superheroes blanket that I have and just sleep. It was very upsetting because then my mind starts wandering. I'm like, well, who would have drawn it? Like Jose Luis Garcia Lopez? You know, like, oh, no, don't go down this road, Rob. That way lies madness. No.
Oh, man, JLGL would have been the only one to really draw that, in my opinion, because it was a special, so he wouldn't have had, like,
there you go.
It's not like a comic. And I know because I asked him once, Jerry Conway loved working with him.
That was deeply depressing, but thank you for starting the show off on kind of a down note.
We can only go up from here,
so that's true enough. So yes, this book is a strange little thing. It is a collection of Superman reprints mixed in with kind of, you know, some historical moments from Superman's career and then just kind of random ephemera. It really kind of feels like almost like a Superman scrapbook, which I guess is kind of what it is, really, in a certain way. But it feels like the kind of thing that you would put together in an era before the internet, where this stuff is just not, you know, now it's available, you can find it anywhere. But, and we'll get to it, but like there's sections of, like, you know, trade ads and, like, you know, the splash page to a story that they don't reprint, you know, it's, and, like, you know, photos from the live action play, you know, from the It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. Like, it really feels like it is a sort of history of the character, but also kind of not really, because some of the stories they print are not, you know, not particular. It is again, we'll get to it, but it's a strange duck for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it contains a giant poster map of Krypton.
Which very, very happy that DC went to the trouble of printing that for the original and inserting it into the book, because it's an extra piece that they have to put in. And we'll get to the one, I think, kind of unfortunate piece of the Krypton map. We'll talk about it when we get there. But the cover, and of course, we'll have you know, pictures of this on the gallery page on fireandwaterpodcast.com. The cover is a drawing of Superman. You're better at this than I am, Michael. I'm assuming is that Swan Murphy Anderson Superman? Would you, to your eye, is that what that looks like?
Kind of, but the face is not a swan.
No, it's not.
That's kind of a
I when I looked at it glancingly, I was like, oh, that's got to be Swan Anderson, because the body is so totally a Swan Anderson. But yeah, the face is a little, I wonder if somebody like touched it up or something. Because DC was known to do that, as we know.
What audacious person would do that?
Yeah, exactly. it's got this thing of him holding up a giant globe, and it says "Amazing World of Superman." Strangely enough, he is sitting on a Superman logo that is not the classic Superman logo. It's an altered version of it. It's not the one from the comic book. For some reason, it's
not a really attractive one either.
No,
honesty.
Yeah.
Mike's Amazing World says that's Swan and Anderson. So okay. I guess maybe somebody did like touch up the face or something.
Yeah.
Like,
somebody even pasted up somebody in the, you know, one of the woodchucks it or something like that. So, yeah, let's get right to it. Let's get to these again, the kind of interesting stories. By the way, this book is in black and white, which is kind of with washes, you know, like somebody went in and put in like wash tones, which again is kind of a curious choice. I can't imagine that the publishers, which I would assume were DC, wouldn't spring for the money for color, you know, in 1973. I mean, but you know, no, it's black and white. So okay. And the reprint is in black and white, which is again sort of a curious choice, but I guess they didn't want to spend the money to color the whole thing in the first place. So anyway, the first piece is an actual story from a Superman comic. It's Superman in Superman Land, fitting. It's from Action Comics number 210 by Bill Finger, Wayne Boring, and Stan Kay. And I love the little on the splash page where you see Superman floating over all these kids in Superman Land, and everything's, the kids are oohing and eyeing. I love the little details. It says, from fiction to fact, this Superman story was conceived back in the year 1955. Now the fiction will become a reality in Metropolis. Guys, don't oversell it. All right.
Let's not cash write that check until the Superman land is built.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be a Kryptonian babooch before I get to see something as cool as this, because the land as we're seeing it is this incredibly Art Deco kind of thing with like these giant words like Krypton spelled out on tops of buildings. I mean, you're kind of promising something to kids that they really can't, they're not going to be able to deliver. The plot of the story is as such: Clark, Lois, and Jimmy attend the opening of the new Superman Land theme park. While Clark tries to keep Lois from making the connection he is really Superman, a mysterious figure skulks the park. When Superman himself arrives to sign autographs, the figure reveals himself to be, of course, Lex Luthor, who attacks the Man of Steel with some synthetic kryptonite. Luthor attempts to send the weakened Superman into space, but he escapes, defeats Luthor, and rejoins Lois just as she is leaving the park. So, all right, Michael, as a story, what did you think of this as a Superman adventure?
This is from kind of a weird era of Superman, because it's right in the middle of the 50s. I think Bob Fisher would probably call this the Atomic Age, because we're not quite to the Silver Age yet, but we're definitely not in the Golden Age. And because of it, you got the Wayne Boring art. I love Wayne Boring Superman.
Me too.
My first Superman stories were Superman from the 30s to the 70s, which was chock-a-block, as you would say, with Wayne Boring artwork. And because of it, there's not really like a big fight or anything. And it's Clark Kent just trying to keep his identity secret. And you know it's kind of an Atomic Age story because Luthor has synthetic kryptonite. Mm-hmm. This is before that would become like ubiquitous in the 1960s. But I think it's charming. I think a kid waking his dad up at 5:30, I would never have done that. Even if I was going to Superman Land, I would have just waited for him to wake up. You know, not that my father was like a jerk or anything, but 5:30 in the morning, geez.
That's pretty early, yeah.
And, you know, they say that this is about to become a reality. Probably wouldn't have been nearly this cool. But years ago, I had this really cool idea after going to Disney World, where we did Star Tours, that you could do a really cool ride of Escape from Krypton, doing like that thing. Where you're in a thing that's moving and you're like on Krypton and you see like Jor-El putting you in the ship and everything and it rockets off.
That's fine.
And you
have to, yeah.
And they kind of do that in this story. I don't know if amusement parks were up to this kind of thing in the 1955.
No, I don't think they really had the technology to deliver these kinds of thrills.
On the other hand, that's really prescient to guess that that's what we're going to be doing in the future. Because there's a lot of rides like this. There's a Minions ride at Universal that's kind of like this, where you're just strapped in and everything moves and like like air bursts next to you and your seat kind of jerks around. And, but this is just one of those things where this could have been an episode of like the George Reeves series, in all honesty. Because all he's doing is just helping out at the park. Like, he's standing in for a Superman dummy. He's he has to put in an appearance. Lex Luthor traps him. He gets out of that trap using the acid that they're etching the kryptonite with. Because, you know, you really want to get acid around kids. then again, it's 1955. People smoked while you were, like, in the doctor's office.
Exactly.
In 1955.
Exactly. So. People were tougher back then.
But no, it's fine. I can't say this is like this will never make the greatest Superman stories ever told, but it does end on the Superman Land certainly was super fun. The only thing that disappointed me was that I did not get to see Superman on purpose. That's what you think, Lois. And then you have the like at the end.
He winks right into the camera and that kind of thing. Yeah. My favorite detail actually is when Wayne Boring and Stan Kay draw the mob of kids. Mm-hmm. Every panel, the way he draws their faces, they kind of don't look like they're overjoyed. They look like they're out of control. Like all the kids are like, ah! Like they look like it's like
they this look like reefer madness. For yeah, kids.
It's like the place is on fire or something. They don't look like a happy bunch of mob kids. They look like they're just like wrecking the place. And it happens in multiple panels and sort of just made me laugh. But yeah, I mean, look, obviously this is the kind of thing where you're like, boy, if this kind of thing could exist, it would be absolutely amazing. And we'll before we wrap up, we will talk about the real Superman Land and kind of what happened to it, because it never really got off the ground. So that's the first story. And then we have some bonus features here. I guess the whole thing's kind of bonus features in its own way. There's How to Draw Superman. So there's a little thing from Kurt Swan, that's Kurt Swan, Murphy Anderson, I'm guessing, showing you know, headshots and things like that, different poses and things like that. So it doesn't really help you draw Superman in any real way, but okay.
I was about to ask you, like I'm looking at this.
How does this help?
No, they don't even do like the ovals with the, you know, where the, and they,
yeah, the skeleton, the right? Yeah. No. They just show you some pencil sketches, which is fine. Then there's a guide to the characters in Superman family portrait. So Superman and all of his friends. There's a little thing, the Super Family, how it came from Earth to Krypton, explaining the trip. Then there's a large piece called How a Comic Magazine is Created. And it is a step-by-step process showing you how a basic comic book starts from beginning to end. There's a photo of Julie Schwartz with Carmen Infantino talking to Nick Carty about the cover that he's working on. And then it's, you know, just photos of different people working on a Superman comic. And you've got, there's a drawing of, I'm not drawing, excuse me. There's a photo of Denny O'Neill literally typing a script. There's a photo of Kurt Swan. There's a photo of kind of the, you know, the DC version of the bullpen working on the color separations. Then they go all the way actually into, there's Alan Kupperberg doing some corrections on an art page. There's Joseph Letteries making lettering, with the perfect name for a letterer. Then you see the actually take photos of the printing plant and showing you kind of the proofs, and you see all the photos. And then they even get into like the foreign editions, and it's like, it's kind of funny when you look at this and you look at all the work that goes into a single comic book. You're like, how did anything ever get created? Like, it's just so much work.
It's kind of fascinating. The one thing, just going back for a second, in the How the Super Family Came to Work, for years, there was a thing on this that I was just fascinated with. Historic accident, Super Baby's rocket jars against an alien spacecraft laden with weird machines. One of these created a duplicate of Super Baby, which grew up to be Super Menace. That's a story where this family raises this clone of Superman and raises him to be a villain, but it turns out to not be a real person at the end.
Okay.
And he ends up, and they're criminals, so he ends up taking them out after fighting Superman. It's a weird story. It really is. I'm surprised they put them there.
But it's it's a fun little feature. It's cool getting to see the behind the scenes of how it worked. If this is not something you were familiar with, it was pretty neat.
As an artist, would you draw in a shirt and tie?
No, I would. No, I know that I think the dress code at DC was a little more formal than it was at Marvel. So, I highly doubt they made everybody wear a tie. I think they knew, hey, we're taking photos for the book, so, you know, look nice today. We clean up the offices, you know. But yeah, it's a fun little feature. And then there next is another comic book story, which is The Origin of Superman by E. Nelson Bridwell, Kurt Swan, and Murphy Anderson. And this is pretty much what it sounds like. It is the classic golden age, well, silver age, origin of Superman retold, done pretty much as straightforward as you can get. And it was funny when I looked this story up on, this is actually original.
Yes.
This edition, this was made new for this book. And it's sort of funny how iconic this origin is that if you look it up on Mike's Amazing World, this story has been reprinted, I think, like 20 times in different Superman books. It's just exact. It's everything that most people would know about the Superman origin. It's all here.
Yeah, I think it was reprinted in that Super Secret Origins of the Superhero book that was published in the 70s. Yep. I recently got on eBay something I'd wanted for years. It was this Superman Through the Ages DC Direct 4-pack action figure thing, where you had like a Golden Age Superman, a Burn Age Superman, a Superman robot, and what was the fourth one on that? I'm looking at him right now. But I wanted it, and in the back of it, they had a comic And I just am baffled. Like, you know, you're confused by certain things with this one. Let me pull it, because I actually got it right here. So it reprints this story in full color. By the way, it actually looks better in this than in any of the reprints I've seen.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think the wash does better with the with the artwork. So it reprints Action Comics number one. It reprints this story. And you're like, okay, so that's the first appearance of Superman. It's Superman's origin. What would the third story be? Superman 7 from 1987, where he fights Rampage.
Of course, yes.
I mean, it's a no-brainer. Not Man of Steel number one. No, we're going to do this random story from 7 months into the new thing. But no, I like this one mainly because I think it's some of the most dramatic I've ever seen of this Krypton dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the shot of the rocket taking off. I just think it looks great in the black and white.
Okay.
And they take a lot of time explaining like how they discovered all of his powers too. Later in the story, I think this is like, if you're ever going to reprint like a collection of Superman origins and you don't put this in it, you're wrong.
Right. I mean, it's every beat that, like I just said, it's got everything that you would know of a Superman origin. You know, it's just every element, the Jor-El and Lara, and then the Kents discover him, and then the baby's got powers, and then Pa Kent dies, and he goes, you know, he becomes Superboy. I mean, this is the kind of thing Ian B could write in his sleep. And, you know, I mean, it's incredible. And they get drawn by Kurt Swan, the Superman artist of the time. So, I mean, it's about as iconic as it's going to get.
So did he really bury his parents in the backyard?
You're asking me. You're the expert.
No, I just noticed it's something that didn't click with me. I figured he would have done it on a golf course to get a tax break. And what I like about it is that it mentions the cake. Like, of all the things from the various Superboy stories, it mentions that he baked them a giant cake. Like, they all got into the football field, like a field, and I don't know how they coordinated this. Like, did you have like a dude on like one of those like scoop things that electrical companies use to get to the high wires? And like, okay, move to the left. Okay, you move to the right. Okay, you got farewell, Superboy. Everybody mark your place.
Yeah, the cake, they do devote like a whole panel to the cake, which is, that's an element I never knew of. So yep. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's kind of an important part of the origin, is that it gets its own panel. But okay. Yeah, I never really thought about that. Yeah, he does bury the Kents in the backyard. That seems a little odd. They didn't bury them out where, you know, in the movies, you know, Pa Kent's buried out in Smallville graveyard like everything else. But okay. But yeah, so I mean, if you're trying to, you know, do the history of Superman, that this is exactly the kind of thing you want to do. And it's cool that they commissioned this for the Treasury, so that's really cool. So next there's a page of Superman Syndicated, which are just some strips of the Superman newspaper strip, including his appearance where he teamed up with Steve Allen, which is the thing I never knew about. I eat this stuff up. When I was a kid, I never had access to these newspaper strips because, of course, they were, you know, long gone before my newspapers ever were around. And so anytime they would reprint these, and, you know, the classic Two-Face storyline and the Batman Treasury. So now they're available, you know, in print. You can get them and stuff. But at the time, I love this stuff. And I wish they would have done more of it, because it's like, oh, man, these are Superman adventures I'd never get to see otherwise.
Yeah, a lot of the early ones would be reprinted in the comics, like the first couple strips after the origin, which, by the way, this is my favorite Superman bit of minutia. The origin of Superman, as in showing Krypton and like showing him being rocketed away, and outside of like the one panel thing and like Action number one and Superman number one, they didn't actually show it in the comics until 1945 with the first appearance of Superboy. The first time people at the time would have seen it was in the very first Superman, the first serial of the strip, where they go through like the end of Krypton and him being launched to Earth and found by a kindly family. But you get to see like Jor-El running through the city, and he's going to be by his wife, and him discovering that the planet's going to be destroyed. None of that in the comics until 1945. Huh. One of the most important characters in history. And they're just like, nah, we'll get around to the origin. It'll be fine. I also love how violent Golden Age Superman was. He throws this dude out of a window.
That's great. Yeah. No F's given with the Superman. Yeah, I really do like him.
He really was like that. They actually calmed him down to make him more like Batman in the comics.
Help me. I'll try my best.
But yeah, seeing Steve Allen, I'm like, wow, that's something that I don't even know if the kids of 1973 would really know.
Yeah, I know. I think Steve Allen was kind of already, you know, a little bit out of the most kids would not know him at that point. He would not host the Tonight Show in 10 years or whatever. But yeah, I said this is the kind of thing I wish they had done more of than just one page. Mm-hmm. I wish they had showed a lot more of this because it's cool stuff. Next up, there's a feature on Metropolis, Illinois, which is going to be the home of the future Superman Park. And they had this event where they had a guy dressed as Superman who apparently was a preacher. Reverend Charles Chandler, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Metropolis. He plays Superman, which seems like an odd choice. You would think it'd just get like an actor or something, but no. And so he dressed up as Superman and they did like this whole event. And the whole bit was Superman Land was it was going to be a theme park, and it never opened. Now they blamed it. The reason it never took off the ground is because of the OPEC crisis, the oil crisis, and costs went up, and they said that like they, you know, I don't even know why that, and that's because even know why that would have anything to do with it exactly. On the little card that they inserted with the reprint edition, which comes loose, you know, with the book, it mentions, it just says like the oil crisis killed the park before it ever took off. The one I tried to do some research on Superman Land, I couldn't find anything on it. Why it never opened, other than one website that had a very oblique reference saying that they never really got proper funding before it ever launched. So it never went anywhere. The proposed cost in 1973 for this park was $50 million.
Oh, good Lord.
Which in today's money is $333 million. Like, how are you ever going to pay for it? Who was going to drop $300 million, the equivalent in 1973, for a Superman park? I mean, come on, guys. Think a little realistically here.
So there's a part of me that would have loved for this thing to be built.
Oh, of course. Of course.
There's another part of me that realized it would have failed in the mid-'80s. And then you would have just had like this abandoned Superman world,
which is perfect creepy. Haven for Batman villains to take over and plot their next crime.
On the other hand, Metropolis, Illinois has become a really cool spot for Superman fans. Every year in June, except for 2021 when it was in July, or August, they had to, you know, because pandemic. They have, it used to be like a 4-day, now this past year was a 3-day, a 4-day Superman celebration. There is a giant statue in the middle of the city of Superman.
With his hands on his hips, that picture with Obama in front of it. I've seen that picture a million times.
Which is right next to the Superman Museum, which is run by Jim Hambrick and his family. This museum is amazing. I could have spent all day in there. And it was in that museum that I discovered how reflective the Phantom Zone costumes from Superman the movie was. Because I took a picture of it, and when it came out, they were red. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And Chris Franklin and I talked about the creepy statue with the head that'll make you wake up screaming. But it's so much fun because it's a comic book convention combined with like a state fair.
Okay.
So you've got cosplayers, you've got comic book professionals, you've got celebrities, and you can get funnel cake.
Sure.
And there was a moment in 2008 where I'm literally standing in the middle of the main street And to my left, I saw the statue and all the people milling about it. And I look to my right, and there's people doing dirt bike tricks.
Okay.
And everyone's nice. Like, no one's a jerk. I hung out mainly with a bunch of people from the Superman homepage. It was the first time I got to meet Steve Unis face-to-face. And we formed a little, like, group that hung out the entire time. But it was so much fun. I got to meet Murphy Anderson.
Oh, wow.
That year. And he signed my From the 30s to the 70s. Very nice.
Oh, band. That's great. That's
and,
great.
And what's his name? Mark Tyler Nobleman was there, and he gave a presentation about his Superman book, and he was super nice. I met Michael Urie, and that's how I got my first back issue, my first and only back issue assignment. But I interviewed Michael Urie for Views from the Long Box, and he was super nice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is. Yes.
So it was just, it's like, when we went, we're like, we're going to go once. And we haven't been back since just because of real life. We were going to go in 2013, but that was right after Rachel's wreck. And it's just like, I'm not going to put you in a car for 6 hours.
I can drive to Superman land.
So I can drive to Superman. Metropolis, Illinois is a little postage stamp of a city. It's very small. And it's right near Paducah, Kentucky. It's like right over the border from that. And I just have this memory. I know this is a weird tangent, but I had a memory. So it's the festival's over. We've said goodbye. A bunch of us are still there for another day. So we're going to go see a movie. So all these Superman fans piled into a theater to watch The Incredible Hulk. Because it had just come out that weekend. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll never forget. I'm sitting there. I'm getting my soda and popcorn. And the guy behind the counter is just like, hey, where are you guys from? I'm like, well, we were in Metropolis for the Superman thing. And he's just like, oh, I'm more of a Batman fan.
Well, then, sir, you are my enemy.
I'm like, okay, that's fine. Everyone's like, are you trying to start a fight? I mean, are we going to have to fight all like the ushers? And now it's going to be this huge battle in the movie theater. But no, if anybody is a fan of Superman or just a fan of going to like a comic book convention, it's hot because it's the middle of June, but it's so much fun. I'm literally, it's like the Muppet song. I really hope to go back there someday. Just to see people that I know, because I'm still friends with people I've made friends with on Facebook. Like, we still all associate, and some of them go to Dragon Con too. So it's a lot of fun. Sorry, I hijacked the show to talk about Metropolis.
Well, you don't bring Michael Bailey onto your podcast if you're not expecting him to hijack the show at some point. I mean, come on, let the cat caveat emptor, everybody. No, that's really cool. I mean, that, you know, we always talk about among the Fire and Water Network, we talk about, you know, doing a meetup every year. And of course, obviously with the pandemic, that stopped that for a little bit. The Superman, you know, Metropolis, Illinois for Superman, the Superman event, that's one of the things we talk about. We're like, oh, that'd be kind of fun. You know, that sort of thing. We haven't obviously put it into practice yet, but it's on kind of like the maybe list. Cause I'd like to see that. That would be pretty cool. And, you know, I'm glad that it exists. That's great. It's kind of funny that you're like, wow, they really, you know, the whole museum based on one character, that's incredibly unique. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, Walt Disney is Disney World. It's everything, but this is just devoted to this one character. And again, obviously the park that was mentioned in the story we covered, and then let alone the one that Neil Adams drew in that other Superman treasury. Yeah. Which would have cost $400 trillion to make, you know, that nothing that impressive, but you know, it's cool that they're, that thing exists. And I know they get guests from the movies and all different eras of Superman. So that's really cool stuff.
Yeah. A couple, in 2013 or 14, Michael Rosenbaum, and the guy that played Hamilton on Smallville came to the, and they just crashed a party.
That's great.
There was this party, and like it had kind of ended, and a bunch of people went home, but a bunch of people were like just sticking around and hanging out, and suddenly Michael Rosenbaum shows up.
I'm partying with Lex Luthor / the Flash. Yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, digging it. All right, that's awesome. So yeah, there's this article about the park. I do have to mention it shows the governor of Illinois at the time, Governor Dan Walker. And anytime you show a politician from, you know, that I'm not familiar with, I feel the need to look them up and like, did they get in any sort of trouble afterwards? And while he was governor, he was a fairly nondescript governor. But then he got into banking and he ended up going to jail for bank fraud. So he just, yeah, you know, politicians can't help themselves. Unfortunately for Governor Dan Walker. So then there's the Superman legend and his rogues gallery, which is just a little, like, you know, as you might expect, a collection of his most famous villains. There's a little drawing of Superman, you know, introducing his rogues gallery and he's smiling, which is sort of strange. He looks kind of happy, you know, even though he's talking about the Parasite and the Phantom Zone villains and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's all your basic, you know, your big hitters, you know, Luthor, Brainiac, Toyman, although the Puzzler, is he a big hitter? Maybe.
No, you know, no, but he, no. To be fair, he got a Who's Who entry.
Well, he did. That's true. Then, you know, and then you've got the prankster, Mr. McSpittle, like I said, of the Phantom Zone villains. So then there's another story, which apparently is original to the Treasury, which doesn't seem to have a title exactly, but it's the secret, I guess the story you would call it is The Secret of Superman's Fortress. And it's just a 2-page sequence showing you the Fortress of Solitude. And it's drawn by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. And it's just showing you some of the cutaways to the fortress. So, you know, pretty nondescript. And that's just only 2 pages before they move on to something else.
And this takes us back to one of the other times I was on the show when we did Superman and his fabulous Fortress of Solitude.
Oh, now that's a treasury, man. Yeah. That thing. Ross Andrew and Roy Thomas. Good stuff.
I love this thing. It's like kryptonite storage room. These samples are under lead glass for experimental purposes only. I would hope so.
Yeah.
Like, this is how Superman cuts himself to feel. It's just...
Wow, that's grim, Michael. Next up is a sequence on the musical, the Broadway musical. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. It shows you a drawing by the great legendary Al Hirschfeld from the drawing, which is, I love it. I think it's, I don't know, but I would imagine it's probably the only time Al Hirschfeld ever drew a superhero. So I love that drawing. And then it's got some photos of the play itself, and of course they did a TV version.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any video record of the Broadway version anywhere?
Not that I'm aware of. There's plenty of color stills,
right?
Because Bob Holliday published a book, who retired to your favorite vacation spot, the Poconos.
Did he really?
Yeah, cool. He was a land developer up there, and it's funny because this musical is insane, just in general. So you get Hal Prince of Bye Bye Birdie fame to write the songs. And the book is by Robert Benton and David Newman.
Those names sound familiar.
Who would go on to write the Superman films.
There you go.
And it's just like you rarely get people to get a second crack at a character in a different media.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually flew him on stage. There is a story that at one point the line broke.
Oh no!
And he fell 6 feet to the ground. Immediately hopped up and like looked at the audience and said, "Only a Superman could have survived that." And like the place went nuts.
Good ad lib, man. Solid.
I found the Broadway cast recording of this in 1993 at a CD store. And I'd always heard of it, but I had never heard any of the music from it. And it's catchy. Like, the songs were redone a little differently in the TV version with, I think you said, the most coked out Lois Lane you've ever seen in your entire life.
Oh, well, that's the Leslie Ann Warren and the Superman, the auditions. And they had all the different actresses playing Liz. Stucker Channing is Lois. Yeah. And Leslie Ann Warren, and she is just like a majorly coked up Lois.
So, Leslie Ann,
you're kind of like a 14. Can we do like a 7 or something?
But the original Broadway cast had Alice,
Linda Lavin herself, right. Yep.
As the woman who is thirsty for Clark Kent. She has an entire number called You've Got Possibilities.
Oh, okay. Oh, my.
So So, but, and as you see in the pictures, at one point they created a set that looked like a comic page.
Mm-hmm. With right, all the panels, and it even says meanwhile. And it's pretty cool looking.
That was the reprise of It's Superman. And the people that are kind of stacked on top of each other, those were the Asian stereotypes. The acrobats, the Chinese acrobats.
Gotcha.
That Superman fights at the end. But no, it's just the fact that they go so much into this is actually kind of surprising. They get a cast list.
Yeah. And, a lot of information. Yep.
So, and I guess this would have been outside of Enos and Bridwell's introduction to the Superman from the 30s and 70s, like one of the few places you would have seen something like this at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's, they love to stick all this stuff in treasuries, the photos of like real life shows or whatever. So yeah, it's cool. Again, where else would you see it by 1973? You know, again, mm-hmm. they would do a TV version pretty a year or two after this, featuring, of course, Loretta Swit. So
yes,
you got that MASH connection there. But that's, it's neat. Again, this is a very disjointed book.
Yes.
There's no real flow to it. It's all just kind of random features, but as a keepsake of Superman's history, it's delivering what you would want. Mm-hmm. So then there's a page on Superman salutes NASA, and then there's important dates in Superman's life, which goes through various moments from 38 to 71. I'm happy, of course, at the 1966 date, because it mentions the debut of the Superman Aquaman Hour.
Yep.
So I'm just happy that, you know, my man got a mention, at least in this history, a little bit. It mentions the Justice League, of course, and stuff like that. Then there is just the intro page to the Superman's mission for President Kennedy, which was a story that supposedly Lyndon Johnson himself asked DC Comics to publish. Whether, I don't know. I don't know if I buy that story. I think Lyndon Johnson was a little too busy lying us into the Vietnam War to worry about this. But still, it was. I remember reading the story, and it's a nice story. And it's, you know, obviously a historical thing talking about that Superman is a, you know, like a, you know, like a, obviously a force for good, but like in the real world that he is, this is almost like a PSA kind of thing.
Yeah. This is like the presidential physical fitness, which was the bane of my existence in grade school. Effing hated that thing.
Pull ups, Michael, pull up.
Yeah. Nothing for the weak skinny kid, which I was at the time, that really couldn't do anything to ingratiate me to my classmates by the fact that I can't do a pull-up. Right. So
and then the next up is there is another story which I believe is original to this book, the Superman Legend, and it's Superboy's secret hideaways. And so now we're going back in time, and we're seeing Superboy giving us some of his secrets. And then there's a whole thing, the Superboy costume, and it talks about his sort of indestructible costume. It's drawn by Bob Brown. Maybe written by Nelson Bridwell. Now, Bob Brown was drawing the Superboy book at the time, right?
Yes, he was. Yeah. One of the main, and he's got a kind of almost a Nick Carty style to him. Cause at first I thought it was Nick Carty, but then, you know, I looked it up. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. But Superboy at this time, especially in like the early 70s, had the most insane covers.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
There's literally one where Martha and Superboy walk in, and it looks like Jonathan Kent has hung himself.
Yes, I know that one.
Everybody wanted to go into the room with all the Legion statues so you could stand in front of it and get hit by a ray so that you could become the composite Superman.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to become the composite Superman? I mean, come on. So yeah, it's a fun little feature. Then we get a sort of scrapbook of the TV show, and there's a bunch of photos from the show and from the movie. There's a TV guide cover. Then there's the post of the Superman in Exile, which was sort of episodes of the show stitched together and released as a movie. There's mm-hmm. even some selections of the PSAs, the actual, those one pagers that DC used to do. And it mentions for 18 years, DC Comics published 205 different pages as a public service in cooperation with the National Social Welfare and Recreation Agencies in the U.S. I am saying right now, the Fire and Water Network has the ability to conjure things into happening. Right. We somehow managed to do that. I want a book of these.
Yes. No,
I would buy a hardcover book of these in a heartbeat. These are so interesting. They're such a snapshot of what America was like. And you look at them now, right? You think about these were done in 1950. And some of the stuff that Superman and Batman, they were mostly the characters used the most. Nowadays, there would be a large chunk of people who would be like, God, Superman and Batman are so damn woke.
Yeah,
because they're talking about treating people of different skin colors equally, you know, like shocking things like that. Though I would love to see these things collected.
Giving money to UNICEF and talking about the book learning and stuff. Yeah,
remembering that girls are just as equal as boys. They can do, you know, all that kind of stuff. Every time I discover one of these in a book, I try and make a mental note because, like, I absolutely love these things. It would be great to have these all collected. I really think it would have some real historical value.
No, I agree. Like getting redoing the Super Turtle strip too, which kind of is a similar thing. But no, I mean, would DC even have like the stats of these?
I mean, I would think so. I mean, maybe not. Hard to say.
Theoretically, if you have if they still have like the books bound, like the black and white copies, you could scan these and get.
Worst comes to worst, you could scan them. Yeah, you could.
Yeah, and clean it up. I mean, it's kind of funny. You get like a digital copy of a Batman book on Comixology that Neil Adams drew. And like the Neil Adams story is completely recolored.
Yeah.
And then it looks like they just scanned the rest of it.
Yep. Yep.
Like we've spent enough on this. So, but
yeah.
But no, I'm with you. Any kind of ephemera that you can do to kind of explore DC's history. I feel like the same way about doing a Meanwhile book.
That's another thing I would buy in a moment. All those Dick Giordano columns. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because you want to talk about a snapshot.
Yeah,
like the history of a company, but I love that they mentioned like it's fascinating to me that this is the Superman media up until 1973, like the serial, the musical, and the live action show and the animated stuff. That's it, and they have a picture of Superman from Superman Stamp Day. That was a thing that they did. Where to promote savings bonds, basically. So you buy stamps at school and you get enough stamps, you get a bond.
Right.
It was a way for kids to learn to save money. And they filmed this whole adventure with Superman saving Lois Lane and then talking to kids about it. The thing is, unlike the rest of the Superman series, that's not copyrighted. That is public domain.
Really?
So if you ever see a documentary about Superman and they're showing footage from that, the reason is they don't have to ask anybody to do that because they can just do it.
Why is that out of copyright?
It was just something because they did it for the government. It like fell out of copyright. So,
okay.
Yeah. I when I found that, I'm like, how do you let something involving Superman fall out of copyright?
It's like the Fleischer cartoons, you know, like that's mind boggling.
I think the radio show to a certain extent has kind of fallen because they haven't shut down archive.org yet. That has like every extant episode available. So, but it's always fun seeing pictures of George Reeves, like smiling.
Oh, sure. Sure.
You see why he was Superman to like a generation of things. And they have Phyllis Coates. There's no Noelle Neal. I'm actually kind of surprised by that.
Oh, no, I guess there isn't, right? Yeah, because the photos of her, all the photos of Lois are Phyllis Coates. Huh, okay.
It's really strange. Yeah. And one picture of Kirk Allen pulling a car. So, but yeah, I love these posters from the Sitch Together episodes. Yeah,
Superman in Exile, Superman and Scotland Yard, Superman Flies Again.
I saw these. They had those as part of that Smithsonian exhibition back in 1987 to 88 for the 50th anniversary. Because my family went to the Smithsonian a lot when I was a kid. We had family that lived near Washington, D.C. So I got a lot of culture as a kid. And this was the one time that I was just really excited to go to the the American History Museum because I knew the Superman thing was there. And they kind of rushed me through. Thanks, Mom and Dad. that's actually where I discovered that the shirt in Superman the movie was a breakaway shirt. I never thought, I was 12 at the time, so I didn't really think too deeply about these things. But that was one of the things that was on exhibition, the Clark Kent outfit from that scene where he runs across the street and changes into Superman.
Right, right, right.
Huh. So
the one thing that they don't mention in this whole book, which considering it is such a, like, you know, bric-a-brac of Superman stuff, is they don't mention Ray Middleton, the first actor to ever play Superman. Nope. At the World of Tomorrow exhibit in 1940 at the New York World's Fair. Then there are photos of it. So you would think they would have had space to put one panel in and that with a little thing, you know, just, hey, you know, by the way, the first guy ever to play Superman in live action was actor Ray Middleton, who later appeared on an episode of MASH, by the way, second MASH connection. But that's the one thing that they don't mention. You would think that they would, considering they were probably kind of a little desperate to cover all the other aspects of Superman outside of the world of comics.
He was also in the movie 1776, and the moment I discovered that, I was so happy, so I could bring my favorite musical back to Superman.
It all comes back to Superman, as always.
Yes, it does.
Amazing voice that man had, Ray Middleton. He had deep kind of voice like that. You could totally imagine him playing Superman, and the photos of him from the World's Fair are really cool. He looks pretty cool. You know, I mean, it's a stitched together costume. But and then the final page is just a pinup of Superman. I have to assume that's Wayne Boring, or not. He's huge. His chest is huge.
That's Kurt Swan.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
See, yeah, look at that face is Kurt Swan.
Okay.
But yeah, he's pretty big. He's beefy for Kurt Swan.
That's a big, big Superman. And so that's the book, except for, as Mike mentioned at the beginning, there is a special bonus poster, the map of Krypton, which you unfold into four sheets, and it gives you all these different, you know, points of interest on the Krypton, the old world hemisphere, new world hemisphere, the undersea palace, Kandor, the fungus caverns, the ruins of ancient city of Zan, the glass forest, the Antarctic city, the meteor valley, Argo city, which of course, Supergirl's birthplace, Magnetic Mountain, Scarlet Jungle. And then the one kind of unfortunate part, which is Vathlo Island. Mm-hmm. Home of the highly developed black race. I know their hearts were in the right place, but I don't think that really quite lands the way they meant it to.
Yeah, it's not kind of as bad as Tyrox.
Not as bad as Tyrox, the origin of Tyrox, yes. But the idea that sort of all the black people on Krypton live in one area is a little like, okay. But and I didn't, I, you know, I'm not familiar with this thing outside of it, owning it in this this edition. And I have the original copy. Mine doesn't have the poster, so this is the first time I'm seeing it. And when I unfolded it for the first time and I got to that part, I was like, what? Like, yeah. What is this?
But it's a little, I remember thinking the same thing back when I was like 13 and I bought the Superman source book. And it has this image in it. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. Huh? Okay.
Why?
Yeah. Why are we doing this? Why? No, stop talking, Krypton. Just stop. But I mean, it's a nice little feature for them to throw in as a hardcover reprint. I mean, DC certainly probably did, I guess, the best they could. It's pretty clear that the wash pages are just reprinted from the printed edition. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't give it necessarily the crispest look in the world, but maybe they didn't have the originals. I mean, again, we can't assume that DC has held on to every single original ever, because, I mean, that's, you know, millions of pages at this point. And it is kind of baffling as to why they chose to reprint it like last year. It's not tied to anything in particular. Yeah. It's not an anniversary of Superman or this edition, but beggars can't be choosers. I'm just glad they did it. You know, I'm glad that they've been doing these like kind of one a year generally. And like I said, I'm just happy they're doing them.
Yeah, when this was announced, I was just like, OK, because I haven't been as diligent about buying them as you, because I have the originals to, I think, all of the Superman treasuries. I've been trying. I at least tried to collect those. because, you know, if you fall down the treasury hole, it's a you go into some weird parts of town.
Absolutely true.
As you well know. Oh, yeah. And when I saw that, I'm like, huh, that is just weird enough that I'm going to order it. because, like, Superman doesn't get a whole lot of stuff like this. There have been, like, every month I look at the solicits that DC releases, even though I'm not really buying the books anymore. It's kind of like the grandfather from Lost Boys. You know, you don't have to watch TV if you have the TV guide. So I can kind of keep up with, like, oh, that's what they're doing. But I do look at the collected editions because, you know, maybe there's something that I want to get. You know, maybe they're releasing a new edition of The Death of Superman that I need to own. Like they did
need
last month. Yeah.
Need to own.
But when I saw this, I was just like, I have to order this because I have to support this.
Right.
Because if I buy this, maybe they'll do something else.
Yep.
Maybe they'll do the Fortress of Solitude one next, which I think deserves
hardcover. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or reprint like the Superman ones.
Superman versus Shazam. They haven't done that one yet.
Nope. And I mean, DC, there's a movie coming out next year.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, you got a sequel.
Yeah, that's exactly where I am. It's like, yeah, I own Superman versus Wonder Woman. I own Superman versus Muhammad Ali, but I don't care because I want DC to see that somebody is supporting these things. So I buy them no matter what it is. And it's nice to be able to have it and not, you know, I mean, these things are getting more and more fragile as years go by. And so it's nice to be able to read it and not worry about that I'm damaging my original, you know?
And unlike regular size comics, which I know you've talked about on the show before, these things are a bitch to store. You gotta, if you find a box that holds them, you gotta put something in it so they don't flop over. I store mine flat in a paper box, like a box where you get like a case of paper because it's the closest in size of what I have. But when I took this out, I noticed that on my original, the corner had kind of bent a little. I'm like, it's like, I don't need it to be pristine, but I also don't want it to get any more damaged than it is.
Not going to be able to sleep tonight. I keep them all on a bookshelf. I just have a bookshelf from IKEA, and the shelves are adjustable. So the all my treasuries are on one shelf, on the bottom shelf of a bookcase. And so I just make room for when I get a new one, I just slide it in there, and they stay up nice and upright.
And once a month you do the drill of if there's ever a flood.
I have lost a few treasuries in a flood. So yeah, it is a little, I there were ones that I forgot that I didn't have anymore. I went to look for them and I was like, where is this? And then I realized I lost like about 20 to 30 treasuries in a flood. Now, luckily luckily they were the independent ones, like the one-offs, the real weird ones, mm-hmm. So which are on the one hand, harder to find again, but they're not ones I'm really going to do on the show because they're so obscure. And I bought them just for their size. Luckily, the DC and Marvel ones did not get damaged. So those are the ones I've left.
No, and it's weird that the pricing on these things is so random. Sometimes you like see them for in a box, they're like $10 each, which I think is pretty fair.
Yeah.
For things. And then sometimes people want like $150.
Oh.
And I'm just like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they
are. You are crazy, sir.
And, yeah, I've mentioned another time, the last time we went to a con and somebody was selling the Welcome Back Cotter one for $50. I'm like, get the hell out of here. Come on. That's it. That thing's not worth $50. I mean, I guess something's worth whatever somebody's willing to pay for it, but that's, you know, that that's outrageous. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I'm not dropping that kind of coin on these things. But
the treasury made famous by a CNN documentary on sitcoms.
What was that?
They did a history of the sitcom and they went decade by decade, and when they covered Welcome Back Cotter, they showed the treasury cover.
Did they really?
Yes, they did. That.
Oh, that's insane.
I feel like I've let you down now by not mentioning it to you.
No, I didn't know that. Oh my god.
Yeah.
I gotta find that now. I gotta find, oh, that's amazing.
I was just like, Oh my God, it's a treasury on a CNN documentary.
That is boy. I mean, I have to, maybe it's on HBO Max, although at the rate they're going, they're getting rid of more and more content. I should look fast. But that's, I did not know that. I will have to go look for that. That's really cool. That's amazing. So, but yeah, this is, so it's a weird book. It's probably really only for, I would say, Superman, you know, diehards. But again, I'm glad they did it. And, you know, as a keepsake edition, if I had been to the Superman land in 1973, I totally would have bought this. This mm-hmm. is DC's second only treasury ever. Yeah. They did a Rudolph treasury in 1972, which was not given a name. It was not known as limited collector's edition. It was just a Rudolph one off. And then they did this. And then the next year they did the limited collector's edition, starting with Shazam. And that began the run of the actual treasuries. So this is, you know, historical in that it was really early on in there. And thing. And again, it was interesting that the whoever decided to make this, whether it was the park or whether it was DC, decided to do it in treasury size. You know, I mean, that was not standard thought in the time to do it that way. But obviously they felt maybe gave it a little more specialness to make it extra big.
Yeah, I file this under an artifact.
There you go. Yeah,
which isn't meaning to say that it's lesser, but it's kind of like I also have in a box somewhere a replica of the program that they did for a Superman convention in 1976 that had a bunch of stuff in it. Like it had E. Nelson Bridwell interviewing the Earth One and the Earth Two Superman.
Oh, that's cool. That's
and great. I bought it for two reasons. One, it's Superman related, and two. The convention took place when I was born, literally the weekend I was born.
Oh.
So it was like February 27th to February 29th. So it's just like that has, but I look at that. That's not like something that I say is essential to Superman fans. But if you like having artifacts like this, it's definitely worth having. It's worth getting mainly even just for the poster because the poster is kind of cool.
Yeah. It is, as you say, it is totally an artifact. It does not hold up as a book, as like a, you know, something with a beginning, middle, and end. It really is very much a hodgepodge of stuff. But yeah, as you said, as an artifact, as a keepsake, it's fun.
But yeah, and I really appreciate you having me on for it. I've been looking for this for a while now, so I'm glad we finally did it.
Absolutely. So again, thank you, Michael, for coming back. You know, I always enjoy talking to you and having you on Treasury Cast. And there's more Superman treasuries to go. We still have a few that we haven't gotten to, so we'll get to them eventually. But in the meantime, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Yeah, fortressofbailey2.com. That is the home of all of my shows. You know, it all comes back to Superman, From Crisis to Crisis, Overlooked, Dark Knight, Bailey's Batman podcast, Views from Long Box. Basically, outside of like one other show that I've been a part of, everything's there. There's also a link to the third volume of the Jim Beard Batman 66 essay books, because I'm in it. I had my first published work, which I'm kind of excited about. So you can find a link to order that if you want to hear me talking about one of the best episodes from the third season of Batman 66, because it was an actual two-parter, which was kind of rare for that season. But yep, it's all there.
Very cool. You heard him, everybody. So stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. When I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, everyone. My name is Michael Bailey, and I like Superman. Like, a lot. Like, he's my favorite character. I like him so much that I have podcasted about the Man of Steel more than any other character. Back in 2017, I started a show called It All Comes Back to Superman to serve as the monthly reaffirmation of my Kryptonian faith. Well, the monthly thing hasn't worked out, but I'm hoping to change that in 2020. This year, there will be at least one episode a month of the show, and most of those will be part of a series I'm calling Superman is for Everybody. Superman is for Everybody springs from my desire to talk to people that have channeled their love and affection for the character into other avenues, like cosplay, or podcasting, or academia. New episodes will drop in the first or second week of the month, with special episodes popping up at random because that's how I roll, apparently. It all comes back to Super Ann as part of the Fortress of Valitude Podcasting Network, which can be found at www.fortressofvalitude.com. The show is available through Apple Podcasts, the Google Play Store, and it's even on Spotify. It all comes back to Superman. Because really, it does. Give me a few minutes and I'll make the connection. Why are you walking away? I'm not done talking to you.
Hey, Sean, do you want to go over the checklist to make sure we are ready for the next phase of the Batman family reunion?
Sure thing, Paul.
Robin and Batgirl in team-up action?
Check.
Fried chicken?
Check. Man-Bat fighting a were-jaguar?
Check.
Deviled eggs?
Check. Potato salad?
Check.
Without the raisins?
Of course.
The Huntress fighting Catwoman and Poison Ivy?
Check. Lemonade?
Check.
Alfred and Commissioner Gordon keeping a secret from Bruce Wayne?
Check and check. Reprints or all new stories?
New stories and reprints until issue 10, and then nothing but brand new stories from there on out. Giant size issues?
A mere giant size until issue 16, and then dollar comics from issue 17 to 20 through the end of the run in Detective. Guest list?
Absolutely. We're having a number of Bat relatives visit the reunion, so listen in for your favorite Bat cousin.
All right, great. Then we're all ready for the Batman Family Reunion Podcast, where we talk about Batman Family, the great comic book from the 70s and 80s. We'll discuss not only the stories, but also the text pages and ads, and we'll also find out what the Batman family was doing on the newsstands that month.
And since this is a reunion, we're inviting all of you, the Bat kinfolk, to listen in and to be part of the show.
Look for the Batman Family Reunion Podcast on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
And we're back with listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the website, findwaterpodcast.com, for our previous episode, which was number 71, with my guest Nicholas Prom talking about the Flash Gordon treasuries. First up is Chuck Coletta, who says, I really enjoyed your discussion of classic comic strips like Flash Gordon. Over the last several years, I've been collecting the hardcover editions of Dick Tracy, Popeye, Gasoline Alley, Prince Valiant, Steve Canyon, Little Abner, and Peanuts, of course. Newspaper strips were once a much more widespread form of popular entertainment than comic books ever were. I'd highly recommend anything by Noel Sickles, Scorchy Smith, and Milton Caniff. FYI, in 1956, Eva Marie Saint followed up her Oscar-winning role in On the Waterfront by co-starring opposite Bob Hope in That Certain Feeling. Hope plays the ghost artist for a popular and wealthy cartoonist, George Sanders. Jerry Mathers and Pearl Bailey also appear in this movie, which was based on a Broadway play. And then also, Jack Lemmon also plays a prosperous comic strip creator in How to Murder Your Wife from 1965. I have seen How to Murder Your Wife. It's been a really long time, but I remember seeing it back when I worked at a video store, and part of it was that I think he knew he was like a comic book artist, and that was part of the reason I saw it. I've never seen That Certain Feeling. It's funny you mentioned Bob Hope, Chuck, because I'm in the middle of reading a biography about Bob Hope, and it's utterly fascinating reading. And so it's kind of making me want to check out some more of Bob Hope's films. So I will have to get to that at some point. And I will mention, everybody, he mentions Eva Marie Saint, who, of course, appeared in Superman Returns. And Chuck was generous enough to get the legendary Miss Saint to autograph a poster of North by Northwest, the film she appeared in, of course, Hitchcock's film, and sent it to me. And I have it on my wall, and it's right above my autographed photo of Valerie Prine and her Miss Tessmacher get up. And so it's one of my most beloved items. So thank you again, Chuck. I absolutely love that that autographed poster. Edo Boznar says, quote, Kelly's Heroes, they'll always be hobbies to me. Otherwise, though, another fascinating episode about some books I never even heard of. It's yet another case of obscure publishing projects coming to light, for me at least, and it seems like there is a bottomless well of them from the 1970s in particular. Although I have to admit that I had heard of a Pacific Comics Club before, I just didn't know about this specific Flash Gordon book. As for the pinball machine, that is a cool find, and I think it's fantastic that you were able to get it repaired without breaking your bank. Personally, I'm not really into pinball, but I do like any pop culture artifact that's based on the Flash Gordon movie, which is a camp classic that I unironically love. Yeah, Edo, absolutely. I love the movie. It's super fun, and I do love this game so much. Bucky 749 says, great show. I'm a fan of the old Flash Gordon TV show and Defenders of Earth. I'm just wondering, is Prince Valiant a member of the Defenders of the Earth or not? Bucky, having never seen the show, I can't answer that. But luckily, Jack Bone steps in to say, I don't remember Valiant in the TV series or its comic, but there was a similar crossover team up about 10 years ago called King's Cross, where he did show up. Thank you for the information, Jack. Chris Franklin, of course, from our network, says, great discussion, guys. Rob definitely has Flash Mania. It's adorable. I'm extremely envious of that pinball machine as well. It's long been a dream of mine to own a character-based pinball or arcade game. I will just have to live vicariously through my friend a bit longer. Comic strips were definitely more of a prestigious gig than comic book artists at one time, for sure. One reason Bob Kane looked at everyone who touched Batman other than himself as a ghost was because Kane desperately wanted to be a comic strip artist celebrity. If you look at Kane's treatment of the other artists through that perspective, you could somewhat understand, although not excuse, his behavior. I bought some of those modern comics reprints of the Charlton titles right around the time Crisis was happening, and DC had bought the characters. It was kind of neat seeing where Peacemaker and Judo Master came from. One last thing to add on Flash Gordon. Much like Tex Blaisdell with his Alex Raymond gig, I almost got to draw Flash Gordon on officially licensed merchandise. I drew and designed the packaging for an 8-inch Flash Gordon figure based on Buster Crabbe. Castaway Toys unfortunately suffered the loss of their molds to some unscrupulous folks at the factory in China, and their project was scrapped. That is, I knew about that already, but that is, it's a heartbreaking story every time you tell it. And I have seen the artwork that Chris did for it, and it's really beautiful. I mean, it's an absolutely great drawing of Flash Gordon, and it looks like Buster Crabbe, and it would have made a great toy. So that is a huge loss, Chris. I'm so very sorry. Jack Bone returns to say, I'm not as good a Flash Gordon fan as I could be, but I was buying one of the recent reprints of Alex Raymond. The comic shop owner put his old copies of the Dark Horse reprints of the Mac Rabboy drawing Sundays, 48-64, in a more prominent place, and every couple of months I pick one of those up. So I bracketed the Austin Briggs Sundays. What interests me now are the Austin Briggs dailies. Some adventure strips would tell a different adventure in the daily and the Sunday. The Phantom did. I'd have thought with a different artist, Flash Gordon would too. But in 1940, Raymond was also drawing Flash's adventures with the Power Men of Mongo. On Sunday, their bodysuit and cowl were colored red, with their feudal symbol of office being a lightning bolt across the chest. They look like they belong in another comic about another guy called Flash. Pacific Comics Club, here I come. Want to hear a weird theory about the Dan Barry Treasury Collection? Okay. Understand, starting in the 1950s, I blame the release of the movie Destination Moon in 1950, Mac Rabboy started drawing a story about Flash, Dale, and Zarkov returning to Earth. When they finally got here, Zarkov kickstarted our space program. There was the first landing of the moon story, quickly followed by the exploration of Mars, Venus, Neptune, etc., and settling down to space patrol-type stories to the end of his collection. I wouldn't be surprised that Dan Barry continued in that line, especially with Harry Harrison writing. Here comes the weird part. The publisher notices the rise of barbarians in paperback. And John Carter, can't forget John Carter. I started thinking thinking in comic books, but I realized we don't need that. He remembers the sword versus ray gun of Flash Gordon from the 30s and 40s, not realizing the closest the current comic could come to that would be time travel. Interesting theory, Jack. He also finishes up. He says, hey, what about the Al Williamson adaptation of the movie published by Western / Whitman / Gold Key / Dell or whoever? It was a larger size and also longer. Treasury question mark. Yeah, I went looking for that after you mentioned it, and as far as I can tell, it's magazine sized, which is, you know, slightly bigger than a comic book but not a treasury. And, you know, I don't know, I try not to be like too much of a stickler about the show about, you know, what's a treasury and what isn't a treasury, but there's other actual treasuries to get to, so I feel a little guilty about covering something that isn't actually a treasury, and especially since I just did a Flash Gordon episode, I think another one might be a little much, but I do want to get a copy of it because it looks super cool. I mean, Flash Gordon drawn by Al Williamson, you can't beat that. Dallin Bumgarten says, really, really fun episode, great guest, exciting topic, and an American Pickers style pinball acquisition story. What more can anyone ask for? Oh, and then we get some sweet Joe Kubert School mentions and delightful pro artist stories. Gold, pure gold, Jerry. God's work, Rob. Thank you. Keep it up. Well, thank you, Dallin. Paul Kien from our network says, fascinating episode. I didn't even know these existed. I can't say I am much of a Flash Gordon fan, but I love the history you guys presented. Thanks. Thank you, Paul. Brett Michael Young says, first off, Rob, kick ass pinball machine. I remember seeing Flash Gordon in the movie theater when I was young. My friend Paulie's dad took me, Paulie and his brother Joey, to see a matinee. After the movie was over, we loved it so much, his dad let us just sit there in the theater and watch it again. Said this was before cell phones. My mom wasn't too pleased about me coming home 2 hours later than expected, but it imprinted that movie into my brain, especially Ornella Muti's Princess Aura. Not the ballworms. The Flash Gordon collections are definitely no frills, but I like the art. It had an organic nature to the panel-to-panel art, making it look more like movie stills than comic art. Good stuff. Plus, Flash had a good swing with that pipe. He's like a right-handed Kyle Schwarber knocking those Vikings right over the right-field fence. I'm hoping at least three of the listeners will understand that reference. Raise his hand, Brett. Watch the Phillies every night when I can. And then he says, great work as always. So thank you very much, Brett. And yeah, go Phillies. And then finally, Matt Saroy says, first, congratulations on your pinball table. That's so cool. I'd be jealous, but you see, I'm actually a close friend of Flash Gordon. It's no big deal. Sometimes we hang out and watch highlights of his football career or polo career, depends on which versions I'm hanging out with, or we blast off in a rocket and save the universe. Of course, that's only on the weekends when I'm not seeing my supermodel girlfriend. You don't know her. She's from Canada. Looks like I still deal with envy the same way I did in second grade. Thanks for another great episode of Treasury Cast. I'm always a fan of exploring these classic characters and the adventure strips from the newspaper. They are a too often overlooked part of comic book history. A few years back, on a trip with my stepdaughters to Universal Islands of Adventure in Florida, we visited the Toon Lagoon, an area dedicated to classic comic strips. It was great fun explaining all these characters to the girls who were completely unfamiliar with the likes of Flash Gordon, the Phantom, Popeye, and others. The following weekend, when we were back from vacation, we watched the Flash Gordon movie and the episodes of Defenders of the Earth I had on DVD. There's still plenty of magic in these characters, and it's our duty to make sure future generations have the chance to marvel at their adventures. One last question. Did anyone else hear the Queen soundtrack playing in their heads while listening along? I don't use copyrighted music anymore in my shows because I just don't want to get in trouble. But man, it was so tempting to not end that episode of Treasury Cast with some Queen music. But yeah, that is like one of the great film soundtracks of all time. And I never knew about Toon Lagoon. I never even heard of that. That's really cool that they dedicated a whole land to kind of these now obscure characters. So that's really neat. I'm glad that exists. I hope that sticks around. Cause yeah, these are all really fun characters, and the only way kids are going to ever learn about them is you get a chance to see them kind of up close in some form. So that's really neat, Matt. So thank you for that information. So, that's going to do it for the comments. Thanks, everybody. Of course, big thanks to my pal, Michael Bale, for coming by and talking about the amazing world of Superman Treasury Edition or Keepsake Edition, whatever you want to call it. It's always fun talking Superman with Mike. It's always fun having Mike on any podcast, but especially Superman really lights him up, of course. So that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. If you want to follow us on Twitter, just go to @TreasuryComics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it. So that is going to do it, everybody. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
Hiya, boys and gals. There can only be one Superman, of course. Did you ever think about some of the super things that you can do for yourself? Well, like saving up the money for your own vacation, or for that new bike that you wanted so much. Well, all you have to do is just put away part of your allowance or your odd job money and put it in United States savings stamps at school. Those dimes, quarters, and dollars add up mighty fast, especially when you buy them every week on stamp day. Well, the first thing you know, you'll have enough for a savings bond, just like Dad buys for the payroll savings at work. And from then on, the sky's the limit. Take it from Superman.